absolute real pleasure to have with me one of the most popular and prolific English composers, Howard Blake. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
Now, we are in the festive season, so millions of people all over the world will be sitting down to watch a short animation second to none that you scored for. But before I talk about that iconic piece, I'd like to touch on the fact that you've scored for everything, ranging from choral work to opera to numerous film scores. Now, having started playing the piano at the age of 6, would you say you always had an ear to pick out a tune?
Yes, I inherited a musical ear from my mother, who was not a professional musician, but she played the piano and the violin, and she really had a very good ear, so that if anything was even the slightest bit out of tune, she used to wince. And I think I learnt it from her. I actually did. I think I was born with a gift, because I remember that we had a piano, and at the age of 6, I just started trying to play it, and I wrote the names of the notes on the notes so that I could learn to read, and I got into a lot of trouble. Wrote the names of the notes on with indelible pencil, and then I could read. Really, I started reading, but I used to improvise right from the beginning. So it does go back, although I'd never ever dreamed I would become a professional composer. I wouldn't have had the faintest idea.
Oh, so your mother was your greatest critic to start with?
Yes, she was. Yes, she was. And she said, you know, that's the wrong harmony, and you know, you must play things right.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you certainly have. I mean, it's been written that your first extended piece of music was at the tender age of 12. Were people taken aback by this early talent showing itself?
Well, I suppose it is quite young, and I do. I remember that I sat down, I wrote an extended march in D major, and I wrote it all out in ink. And I took it to my piano teacher along the road, and he said, where did you get that from? I said, I wrote it. And he said, you know, you mustn't lie. You know, it's a very naughty thing to do. Said, I'm not lying. He said, well, I find it difficult to believe you wrote that. And he said, if you wrote it, he said, all right. He said, I'm going to take the music away from me. You play it to me. So I played it to him, and he said, oh, you said you did write it. And then he said, well, I'll have to teach you proper harmony and counterpoint and fugue and everything else. And so he did, and I was very, very lucky to have him, because he actually did know all about theory. He was rather better as a teacher of theory than he was piano, because he was really an organist. And my piano playing didn't really advance perhaps as much as it might have done. And for a while at that time, I played from the age of 12. I also played the organ in our local church, and I became assistant organist when I was about 13.
Wonderful, isn't it? So incredible. And I mean, would you say to aspiring composers and musicians, it's good to receive a grounding when you're so young?
Well, I do think so. I think it becomes very much harder when you get older, because you start to become very self-conscious about all the very many different types of music there are, and what are you supposed to write, and what, you know, what is the current trend in writing, all that. At the age of 12, you just think, well, I would like to write music, and how do I make chords sound good, and how do I write counter, how do I put one tune against another? And there is a great body of rules that were discovered over hundreds of years that make up what we know as music. And people think it just sort of happened by chance. It didn't. All those rules are worth learning, even if later you break those rules and you do something else.
Absolutely. You can't break the rules until you know the correct way to do something.
You can't break them until you know them.
That's correct. I mean, I also believe that from the age of 11, you had many singing roles as a boy soprano in church choirs and took the lead in operas like Gilbert and Sullivan. Is this when you found your love of choral music, and did you dream you'd go on to compose this style of music?
Well, I actually started singing in our local church at the age of 7. And there again, I was lucky, because there was an organist choir master called Bartholomew Hales, and he'd just retired, and he'd come down from London, where he'd been an organist at the Temple Church, which was a church with a very, very fine tradition of choral singing and music. And he took me under his wing and gave me lessons from the age of seven in singing. And he actually taught me to sing Bach arias. I can remember it at about nine. I was singing Let the Bright Seraphim, which is pretty advanced, actually.
Yes.
And so I sang in his choir, and I was lead singer in that. And we sang like Tallis and so on. So I had a very good grounding in choral music. When I at 11, I went to the Brighton Grammar School. Their tradition was to do Gilbert and Sullivan operas every year. And in my first term there, they gave us an audition, and they found I got this extraordinary voice. I could sing up to a top C and even further. And they gave me the lead soprano part in Radigore. So, and I was only about 4'10" high, and I sang in Radigore with a tenor who was about 6'5" inches tall, and it looked very, very funny, and it was a great production. So for 4 years, every year I sang the lead in Gilbert and Sullivan. So all of these experiences did go towards knowing about choral music, knowing about writing for voice. And the weird thing is that I started off, of course, at the age of seven as a treble. Then when I was about 13, my voice went down to contralto. I sang Dame Carruthers in Yeoman of the Guard as a contralto. Then my voice broke further. I became a tenor. And when I was at Academy, I sang in the Bach B minor mass as a tenor. And now it's gone down to bass. So actually, I've sung all four parts in my life. So I really do know about which notes are nice to sing and which aren't.
Absolutely. I mean, you couldn't get more versatile than that, could you?
No.
I mean, you said you were talking about the Royal Academy there, you touched on. You trained at the Royal Academy of Music. How did you find your experience studying there? Would you say you easily found your way as a student of the classical music world?
Well, I was very, very thrilled because... I was thrilled because I won a scholarship for piano to the Royal Academy. And this is, I had a marvellous teacher called Christine Pembridge down in Brighton, and she really made me work for a scholarship at the age of 16, 17, I suppose. And when I won a scholarship, I thought this was going to be the most wonderful thing in the world, and I was going to find it terrific. But I actually found it difficult to fit in, and I suppose partly because I'd come from not a professional background. I hadn't been to a specialist school in music, and I'd really just grown up, and I hadn't really ever thought that I would be a musician. It was, I mean, my studies at school, actually the school thought I was going to read history at Oxford, and I was putting probably as much time into academic work as I was into music. So when I won this scholarship, it was, I didn't know what to expect, and I stayed in Brighton because I couldn't really afford to move to London, and I did the whole academy 3 years travelling up and down on a train from Brighton, which wasn't entirely satisfactory because I never really felt I was part of the academy. But there were one or two things in it which really were wonderful. Singing in the choir, as I've mentioned, was with a great choir teacher called Frederick Jackson, and we did Belshazzar's Feast, for instance, and Vaughan Williams, and a great experience of my life. The first year at the academy was there with Vaughan Williams sitting right in the front row, right in front of me, and we sang an entire program of his choral music, so that was inspiring. And later on in the academy, I actually teamed up with the leader of the academy orchestra and did concerts as a violin and piano duo, and giving a lot of concerts around the country. So I think the great experiences of being at the academy were meeting other students and of making music with people at a high level.
Yes, I mean, it's so incredibly versatile there. You seem to be able to turn your hand to every sort of music as a pianist, arranger, orchestrator, composer and a conductor.
Yes, it's
amazing.
It does bother people a lot, I have to say.
Does it? They get a bit insecure.
Yes, they say, how do you do that? You know, and I say, well, I don't really know, but I do it.
You do it. That's the most important thing. I mean, do you thrive on being involved in all different disciplines, and do you feel they all complement each other in a way?
I do. I think to be all music is interesting in some way or other. You can say that. I mean, there's very, very great music on a very, very high spiritual level, as in Beethoven and Bach. And there's music that in the middle, which is entertaining music, which like light music, which is serves a completely different purpose, that entertains people, makes them happy. And then there's music that is ghastly and that upsets you terribly, and all this music that is really tries to generate blackness and darkness. I think there is a huge span of music, just as there is a huge, huge span of consciousness within us all in our own lives.
Absolutely.
So I think to ignore any part of music is probably not a good idea. And I've taken to music, and for instance, when I heard jazz, I thought, well, how on earth do they do that? It sounds so staggeringly clever. So I sort of thought, I really must find out how to do that. And I take that view of most things. And, when I've worked with great people, I remember Henry Mancini asked to score a film for him, and I started listening to Henry Mancini. I thought, this is terrific music. How does he do it? And so it's really that. I've always had a great sort of inquisitive nature about music. How does it work?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's wonderful to have that curious nature, isn't it? And wonderful to work with Henry Mancini. I mean, talking of film, you've scored hundreds of films over the years, ranging from Another Country, starring Colin Firth, in which you received a British Film Institute Anthony Asquith Award for Music Excellence, and to The Duelist, directed by Ridley Scott, for which you were awarded the Special Jury Prize at Cannes for scoring. And what was the process like working on those films?
Well, yeah, it wasn't Another Country, by the way. It was A Month in the Country.
A Month in the Country.
It was called, which was, yes, with Colin Firth, that's right. Mm-hmm. But the Duelist actually was a quite wonderful opportunity and something that I tend to think is really my best, the best original film score that I ever wrote. And I'd at the time that happened, I was down in Sussex, and I was writing chamber music. I was into a huge chamber music phase. I'd written a violin sonata and a cello diversions and the piano quartet. And right in the middle of all this, first of all, I was asked by Stanley Kubrick, wanted some arrangements, and I said, I don't really do arrangements, and I'm terribly busy writing a piano quartet. Anyway, about soon after that, I got a call from Ridley Scott, and he said, I've at last managed to break into the feature film business. I know this sounds impossible because he's now so incredibly famous, but all he'd made was commercials at that time for television, and I had done one or two commercials with him, and he said, you know, I would you write the music for my first ever feature film? And I said, well, I've actually sort of stopped writing commercials, commercial music, and I'm writing chamber music. And he said, well, would you come up to look? I said, well, I'm really terribly busy. And he said, well, could I come down to Sussex? He and David Putnam, this young producer and director, came down on the train to Haywards Heath, and I picked them up there, and they came back to my watermill there in Cookfield, and we spent the whole day playing with this watermill and starting to lay, and then we got, and then he talked to me all about the film, and I said, actually, it does sound fantastic. And he said, will you drive back to London with us and look at it? So I did, and we looked at, and the minute I saw the photography, it was fantastic photography. The very opening shot was wonderful. And I realized that Ridley was like a great master painter who could translate his vision of art into cinema. Quite extraordinary talent for visuals. And we talked about the film, and he was saying, you know, we should put a, you know, should put a bit of electronic music on that. We should put a, you know, a choir on that. I said, no, really, look, you're talking as if you're putting together different television commercials. This is a feature film. You've got to have a score that will unify. You have to have, like, an orchestra which has all the elements you want in it, and then express all those elements within that, so that you have a feeling that the whole film is cohesive from beginning to end. And he said, well, you do it. And I remember David Putnam saying to me, at the end, he said, we want a great big piece like that thing on the end of Tristan and Isolde. I said, you mean the Liebestod? He said, something like that, but for dueling. So I said, how long do you want that for last, for the credits? He said, as long as you like. He said, we'll just make up more credits. You just do what you want to do. So I had a very free hand, which is very unusual. And I wrote a score for a classical orchestra. And I wrote it as they were editing it, and they said, we've got another piece for you to look at. And each time I went to London to see another piece, I was inspired by the next scene. And so when it put it all together, it really was a very interesting score. And strangely enough, so many people have since taken an interest in The Duelist. At the first, it did win the Cannes Festival, but it was regarded as a bit of an outsider, maverick film. But now it's regarded as a great classic. And strangely enough, I'm actually in the process of turning the music of Duelist into a symphony, because I've got a festival of my films in Düsseldorf next year, and they want to premiere this. So that's a very long process from 1977 when I wrote it till 2013 in Düsseldorf.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds a very fascinating process as well, and just very interesting how you can adapt one thing and develop it into something else. That must have been great. I'm sure Ridley Scott really valued your take on everything as well. Sounds like he was learning, doesn't it, at the same time?
Well, yes, well, we're still great friends, and it was a shame, really, that he, from my point of view, he was immediately snapped up by Hollywood. Like, a week after Duelist came out, he was asked if he'd do Alien. And he actually asked me if I'd do Alien, and I said, well, what is it? And I went down to Shepperton Studios, and I went on the set of Alien, and we're talking about it, and But in fact, it was out of his hands, and the American producer said, we want to do it in Hollywood, and we want a Hollywood composer to do it. And so I lost the contact, and I lost Ridley, but I will never forget doing The Duelist with him.
Well, absolutely, Duelist endures, certainly, doesn't it? And a whole legion of new fans, by the sounds of things, as well.
Yeah, I think it shows the quality of something when it endures. Many things come out and they disappear. The following year, they're forgotten. But Duelist is one of those pieces that has stood the test of time.
Certainly has. I mean, I believe your interest in film was first ignited when, after leaving college, you became a projectionist at the National Film Theatre. It was a great way to see films and hear the music. Did it make you want to score films at that moment?
People actually often say to me, what on earth were you doing being a projectionist? But you're quite right. I didn't know what to do after I'd left the Academy. And I had developed a huge interest in films as an art form. I was absolutely crazy about Eisenstein's films like Ivan the Terrible with music by Prokofiev. And I thought that really is the future of art, this, you know, putting together great music and great film. And at the time there were no courses that you could take at university on film or on the composing of film, and I'd really run out of my university grant just by studying piano. But I saw this advert in the paper to assistant projectionist at National Film Theatre. I applied for it and somehow managed to get it, and I spent 2.5 years there. And it was absolutely wonderful. The people were marvelous. And, of course, I found myself talking to film critics and to film directors, you know, which was, it was the mecca of film at that time, and still is today to some extent. And while I was there, I was watching all the people and who I was later to work with. For instance, the great Bernard Herrmann score for Citizen Kane, and 5 years later, I found myself working with Bernard Herrmann. So, you know, and I knew all about film. And actually, it was a great advantage to have a really encyclopedic knowledge of film and the history of film when I came to work with those people.
Absolutely. They must really respect that. And it's something you can really, it's such a common ground, isn't it? Oh, once again, so wonderful to work with Bernard Herrmann. I mean, yes. What film really made you think about composing for film? Was there a film that stood out for you, your favourite film?
Well, I suppose, yeah. I think the. In fact, I remember very clearly. I was in Brighton. I was a student at the Academy at the time, and I was going to go to a concert at the Dome, a classical concert. I've heard all these pieces before, and I'm not terribly interested. And I saw that Battleship Potemkin was on at the Paris Cinema right across the road from the Dome in Brighton. And I thought, you know, I'd really like to see that. And I went in and I saw Battleship Potemkin, and it was this extraordinarily directed silent film, but it had this terrific Russian full symphonic score absolutely matched to the film. And I found that an absolutely tremendous effect, and it really was that moment I thought I really would like to do that myself. So that was really the film that switched me onto the idea.
That was the one. It's beautiful drama, isn't it, in the music and the visuals. It just goes
quite
perfectly
incredible. And I shortly after that I bought Eisenstein's book on film and music and how he analyzed it, you know, that each you can make each phrase of music actually chime with a visual, and you can actually make, you can actually generate the emotion, and you can generate the story by the use of music and exactly how it's placed and how it fits to the picture. If you're working with a great director like Eisenstein, you can do something. And so really that knowledge later I developed to a great degree. And one interesting thing happened to me that after I'd been to Academy, after I'd been in the National Film Theatre, I thought, I've got to get back. I missed playing, and I thought, I've got to get back to playing. And I want to really develop music. And I didn't know how to develop the music I wanted for film. I wasn't sure what to do. So I actually started working as a session musician in Abbey Road. And I started, which was terrific, and I was playing for not only lots of big artists in recording, but that started me off playing piano on movies, and that's how I came to meet Bernard Herrmann and Henry Mancini and Quincy Jones as a pianist. And on one of these occasions, I played piano on one session of Half a Sixpence, which was a big musical. Mm-hmm. And the music director was Irving Kostal, who'd been the musical director on West Side Story. And his editor, I was introduced to his editor, who said, I've produced this book on exactly how you fit music to pictures, and you can actually calculate exactly we've hired this time from the University of Southern California, and I've got this book, and I've got a very limited edition. Would you like this book? His name was Carol Knudsen, and this was 1965. And I bought the book for the enormous sum of £50 from him, and it had my name printed on the front in gold. And actually, that gave me the whole key to how you made picture fit absolutely exactly, and it put me in a way ahead of many people in London by that knowledge. And I then started really gradually writing four films as a composer and conducting them.
Oh, incredible. I mean, you're such an incredible composer and writer, and the people you've worked with there are just astounding. I mean, it's you were commissioned to write the orchestral score for Flash Gordon, and you were also, when you talk about Abbey Road there, you had the pleasure of working with Laurie Johnson on the hugely successful series The Avengers. Did you feel this is going to be as popular at the time as it became?
Well, how that happened was this, that as I said, just soon after I started working at Abbey Road as a session, as a recording pianist, one of the jobs I was asked to do was play on the Avengers series up at Elstree, and that was at the time of Dinah Rigg and Patrick McNee. And so I played on that for about a year or more on a series on that Dinah Rigg series. And Laurie Johnson was the composer and of both the theme tune and of all the background music. Now, it happened that Laurie actually got busy, and he was writing. He wanted to write a musical for Drury Lane, and he was looking around for a composer to take over writing the background scores for the Avengers. And Laurie, it's funny how things connect up. Laurie was a great friend of Bernard Herrmann, and he was talking to Bernard Herrmann about it, and he said, "Do you know of anybody who you think could take over from you?" And Bernard, who I'd got very friendly with, and I'd shown him a symphony I'd written, and Bernard said to Laurie Johnson, "You know," he said, "I think you'll find your own pianist, Howard Blake, could actually do it for you." So next time I was up at Elstree, Laurie said, "You know, would you be interested in taking it, writing it?" And I was absolutely flabbergasted that he'd asked me. I said I would be absolutely thrilled to do that. I said, when do you want me to start? And he said, "Next Monday."
It's fantastic, isn't it? I mean, what an experience. But then you've had so many experiences. I mean, thousands of musicians dream of being discovered by an EMI talent scout. But that's what happened to you, and I believe led you to Abbey Road, working with the likes of the Rolling Stones and Tom Jones. It must have been quite an experience.
Well, yeah, that's a bit earlier than... That's just before the Avengers, really. So, mm-hmm. But, so 2 years, there was 2 years, about 65, 66. And it's absolutely true that I'd come out of work at the National Film Theatre, and I thought I want to play piano, and I want to try to play piano of all sorts, and I want to play with bands and try this and try that. And I was playing in a club in Leicester Square, and a chap came up to me and he said, "Would you be interested in doing an audition at Abbey Road?" And I said, "Who are you?" And he said, "My name's Paramore." And I knew that Norrie Paramore was the head of Abbey Road Studios. So I said, when would you like me to come?" He said, "Tomorrow morning." So I went up to Abbey Road, and the orchestral manager there, Laurie Gold, he said, "Look, play this, play that. Can you improvise? Can you play classical music? Can you play jazz? Can you play rock?" He said, so he gave me this audition, you know. So he said, "Would you be interested in being a session musician and recording career, you know?" So I said, I would. So I started then and there, and that's actually true. The very first record, I think, was actually, believe it or not, working with Paul McCartney and the Scaffold on a record called Thank You Very Much.
Oh, wonderful.
With Paul McCartney on tambourine. Uh-huh. And it was a very interesting place to be, because Jimmy Page was playing guitar there, and John Paul Jones was playing the bass guitar, and Clem Cattini on drums. All these people who became megastars actually were all starting off as session musicians at Abbey Road.
Yeah, I mean, what a creative sort of hub, really, for everyone to be in. It sounds absolutely fantastic. I mean, most people would think working with some of the biggest names in pop would be exciting and exhilarating. Was this how you saw it, or did you find the pace a little frantic?
Well, it was a very interesting time to be there, and what was great about it, really, that there was this pool of musicians, not only guitarists and drummers and so on, but they called in all the great classical musicians would play on record sessions and on film sessions and television sessions, and there was a very great deal of music going on at that time in London. For a number of reasons. One reason was that most of Hollywood had actually come over to London because of some sort of dispute going on in Hollywood. And London had become the top place to record films. There was also a very, very thriving television industry at that time. And so really, apart from the pop business and the record business, which was booming because of the Beatles and so on, which is, had made England really at the top of the whole tree in that respect. So in a way, to work with all these musicians was tremendous fun. And we go from studio to studio, and they'd be the same people there in different lineups and different categories. And so I learned a great, and it was a lot of fun, which actually came to the day I started conducting and writing the events, all that suddenly stopped. And I missed it very much, really. There was a great sort of camaraderie about it.
Yes, I'm sure. It must have been wonderful. I mean, I believe it was after the hiatus of working in the commercial music world that you took time to reflect, and this led you to a beach in Cornwall. Tell us about that.
I overdid it. After the Avengers, at that time, I was sort of actually absolutely sort of inundated with work, and I went on from, I was asked to do feature films and television films and series, and I really got to the point where it was too much, and I actually found I was shaking. And I went to see a doctor, and he said, "You're overdoing it. You've got to take some time off." You know, which I couldn't believe that I could have got to a situation like that, because I'd always, "Oh, this is so wonderful, so wonderful. I mean, I just want to do it all." Do you know? But I did. I overdid it at that point, and I decided one day to leave London, and I drove down. I thought, I don't know, I want to drive down to the West Country and get away as far away from London, and I need to get away from people and take a rest. So I went, I actually drove down, and I got right the way down to Cornwall, and I rented a hut on a beach in Perranporth, Cornwall, and I took up yoga, and I started meditating. I started taking very long walks along the beach, and I gradually started calming down. And one extraordinary result of that period was that while I was walking along this beach, various tunes came into my head, nothing to do with any films, nothing to do. And one of the tunes that came into my head was Walking in the Air. So that it came from that very huge a period where, in a way, I think I'd escaped, and I was looking for something. I was wanting to go back to maybe the classical music that I'd wanted to write before when I was a student, and this tune seemed to do it for me, and I had a feeling of transcendence about it.
Creative people would say they often get their best ideas walking along, but who would have thought Walking on the Air would come out of walking on the beach.
Perhaps I should have called it Walking on the Beach.
Not quite the same ring.
Doesn't sound as good, does it?
I guess it wasn't really, it wasn't an overnight conclusion, because I believe it took 11 years to fully come to life. But what happened after you walked into a film studio? Tell us about that.
Well, that tune was actually thought up on the beach in Cornwall, 1970. And then, as we mentioned earlier, I then left London and I went down to Sussex, and I lived in this watermill for 10 years. And I started restudying music in all its forms, and I started writing choral works and chamber works and orchestral works. I wrote a big work for the 30th anniversary of the Royal Philharmonic, and I was working with... And then I was also doing the films with Ridley and so on. So I had joined this. And somehow that song, Walking in the Air, I tried it on a couple of things, but it didn't seem to fit, and I didn't really get it right. Then what happened was a very extraordinary thing. In 1981, a friend of mine, whom I'd worked with in Montreal, he's a Canadian filmmaker, and he came over to London, and he rang me and he said, would you like to meet me for lunch? I met him in Charlotte Street. He said, I've just got to drop into this animation company and pick a check up. So we walked in there, and Jerry said to the to John Coates, whose firm it was, it's called TVC, he said, this is my friend Howard Blake. And he said, oh, he said, you're a composer, aren't you? I said, yes, I am. So he said, well, I've just got this idea for it. I've made a little pencil sketch of a thing called The Snowman. And he said, I had some music written for it, which I sort of don't think is quite right. And he said, have you got a moment? Would you just have a look at it for me and see what you think? So I said, certainly, you know, no problem. So he said, it's only 7 or 8 minutes. So I said, so sure. So we went in. He had a little viewing theater in the studio there in Charlotte Street, and he put it on, and the music was sort of electronic. And I said, I don't. Take the music off. Let me just see it. Run it. When I saw this image of the boy and the snowman flying, I thought that song that I wrote on all that years, that would fit like a dream. It's just it's that feeling of transcendence and hope and safety and that the world has infinite possibilities. All of that, and it's something about and this extraordinary innocence of the boy with the snowman, who is an imaginary figure. I thought it will work. So I said to John, I think you could do this whole film without words. Well, your film hasn't got any words, and I mean, who ever heard of a snowman talking anyway? So, and he said, what do you mean without words? He said, oh, you've got to have words. Well, so I think that I can make the music like actually be the script that so that you won't have you will feel that you follow the story exactly. So he said, could you explain? I said, well, I'll do a demo for you and we'll try it out. So he said, all right. So about several days later, I went to a studio around the corner called AdVision, and I put a piano track only against this 7 minutes film with the complete walking in the air over the flying scene exactly as it is now. And when we'd done this and played it back, it made our hair stand on it. You know, we knew we'd got something. That's really how it happened. And then John took it into Jeremy Isaacs in Channel 4. Channel 4 just actually opened like the day before. It was October 1981. Jeremy Isaacs looked at it and he said, I think this is a brilliant idea. We'd love to make it. So in a sense, all the spirits in the air seemed to be working on our side. It all seemed to be terribly easy, as it was with the entire production. When the marvelous, marvelous director, Diane Jackson, who was taken on, she drew it and she directed it, and I worked with her and I got on fantastically well with her. And we then developed it into a whole half-hour film, and I wrote the entire score the following spring when we were able to get going on it.
Oh, I mean, it's just wonderful. I mean, you were very innovative in your suggestion to animate purely with the music and with the script there. It's wonderful. I mean, the words and music seem to match so perfectly for the film The Snowman. You wrote them both. Did they flow with relative ease?
It's an interesting thing was this, that I'd said to John, we'll have it just music. And when I'd said that, I hadn't really thought of having a song. I thought of it all being music. So I actually set about, when I started work seriously on the score the following, I think it was April 82, I wrote the entire score. And I'll tell you how I wrote it, that I had a marvelous editor called Taylor Grant, who, strangely enough, was also Canadian and knew all about timing and animation. They have a great tradition of it out there. And he analyzed the storyboard, as Diane was drawing the storyboard, and we'd say, that'll last 2 seconds, that'll last 2.5 seconds. And he put all this, all these timings down with the exact description of what's happening. So I had a complete, what we call a Bible of timings. And coming back to, you know, my story about Carol Knudsen and the timing book, I was able to incorporate all these timings. So I wrote the music exactly to this storyboard so that all the timings played exactly right. And that's why actually the score, if you listen to it, one bar's in 3-4, one's in 5-8, one's in, it's a very, although it flows, it is actually quite a complex score. And that's because everything fits. And when I put that all together, I wrote the complete piano score, and I recorded the piano score with what was by now a fully drawn film, but mostly in pencil, some of it in color. And at that point, a friend of mine came round, and we sat down and looked at the complete film with the pencil sketch of the entire film with my piano score. And this friend of mine, he says, a pity the boy doesn't sing. It sort of feels, that tune is such a marvelous tune, but there isn't a voice on it. And I said, well, I suppose you're right, actually. And I suddenly thought, well, he's actually not animated to sing. He's not opening his mouth. I said, well, maybe that wouldn't matter. So the next day, and I remember this very clearly, by that time it was June. It was June 82. It was a beautiful day, and I thought, I'll get some sandwiches and a bottle of Coke, and I'll go up to Kensington Gardens, and I'll see if I can write a lyric. So, and I, at that time in my score, it said I'd got section, each section of me has got a little title at the top. It said flying in the air, flying through the air. It said. So, as I came down the stairs and I was getting my picnic, and I thought I'll walk up to the park, and I thought walk. And somehow walking in the air. And I thought, I've never heard anybody say walking in the air. I thought, that's perfect. So I went and sat in a deck chair the whole day for hours, and I wrote the lyric complete. And I thought, that's it. And I've never changed a note, a word of it from then. And then we had the problem of who should record it. And John very much wanted to have it like a boy from a local school, we called it. And we tried with two or three, but we found it just didn't work because it really needs singing quite marvelously, and you really need a very, very trained voice to sing it. So I rang a soprano friend of mine, Elaine Barry, session singer, and I said, where could I find the best treble in the world? And she said, St. Paul's Cathedral, and the greatest trainer is there, Barry Rose. And she rang him, and he agreed. He said, I'll line up six of the boys, and you can choose one. So we went down on Sunday after evensong, and I said, that boy there's wonderful. So that's how Peter Orty came to sing it, and that's how Walking in the Air happened.
Amazing. I mean, as a boy soprano yourself, did you find that helped having the ear to select that purest voice?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, although I can't sing now to save my life, which is a shame, I do know about singing, and I spent all my youth, as we said just now, all my youth singing. So I've always had a very great fondness for singing and for sort of knowing how to write for voices.
I mean, at this point, can I just say thank you so much for creating such a enduring magic. It really is such a beautiful and emotive score. I mean, the part of the score when the little boy comes out to see his friend melted, it gets me every time. My lips quivering now just thinking about it. But, I mean, did it take you a while to select the correct instruments you felt were right to reflect those poignant moments?
Yes, I mean, I decided to use... It's quite a small orchestra, actually. It's as two flutes, one oboe, two clarinets, one bassoon, and I thought one trumpet, two horns, and then harp, piano, percussion, and strings. And there were not a very big string section. I think it was actually only six, four, two, two, one, as we say. So so it was quite small. But so really, a great deal of the, it's really written like a chamber piece for chamber orchestra, in which all the instruments are solo, and I think that gives it a purity, so that each action that they have, you know, it is played by a solo bassoon or a solo oboe or a solo clarinet or solo piano, and it makes up a patchwork that actually fits to the whole film. And so when the boy flies back and lands, you hear it's a solo oboe, and then he walks, and when they shake hands, then a chord on strings, as is the warmth of that handshake. Then you have so violins only play the moment of melting, and then the solo piano comes. So in a way, it's also unusual. If you take many film scores, I have got a huge orchestra bellowing away all the time. Really, it's like a tapestry of solo instruments.
Wonderful, it really is. How does it feel when you watch the innovative animation of the film, The Snowman? Do you think, you know, I've created such a magical score?
Well, it's a long time ago, but I mean, again, it has stood the test of time, and I think it's being run for the 30th year running this year on Channel 4, and what also happens is all over the world, people do concert performances of it with the film. And I'm, for instance, on Christmas Day this year, there is a performance in Potsdam, Berlin, by the Frankfurt Symphony Orchestra. And it starts with the overture by Leopold Mozart, Christmas Sleigh Ride. And then there's The Snowman by Howard Blake, with film. So that's quite an honor. And I mean, to think that a little children's animated cartoon from London can reach there. It's also been done in all over the world, in China, Hong Kong, in America. So it really is a complete global success in a way.
That's right. I mean, as well as appearing on our and delighting us every Christmas Day, that The Snowman's played and performed in every country, as you say. I guess the story is so universal, and the music reflects the joy, hope and pathos. I mean, why do you personally feel The Snowman is so universally loved all over the world?
I think it's a very inspiring film in that it is actually a classical, it's a piece of classical music, in fact, and yet it sounds absolutely of this age, and it sounds absolutely contemporary. And I've always felt that, you know, in the 60s we went through a gigantic rock and roll period, and then classical music went off into a corner and did lots of experimental things with electronics. And in a way, I think I found what I felt was a voice which was neither of those things, but it was like a pure music which has melody and has expressive melody and emotional melody, and it communicates to people directly whether they like one sort of music or another. And I think that it just seems to flow. And the story itself is a story about friendship, and the fact that the very interesting fact that the boy actually, he makes the snowman. The snowman is an adult who doesn't know how the world works, and he's just this creature. And he goes into the house, and the boy is able to say, "Look, this is how the light switch works." He is able to express that incredible joy that we all have as children of saying, "Isn't this world wonderful? Look at that! Isn't that marvelous?" And that's something you don't often get in films. This feeling of innocence, and it's perfectly expressed through this story.
Yeah, it really shows us like the wonder, excitement and sort of innocence of childhood, and walking in the air just lifts our spirits and transports us to a magical place. I mean, as a composer, you must never stop. And when we last spoke on the phone, you talked about two theatre shows that were featuring your work that were just opening. It's such a delight to hear The Snowman's going to play at the Peacock Theatre for Sadler's Wells for its 15th consecutive year.
Well, that's it, yes. I mean, how that happened, I mean, The animation film we've been talking about so far, that was made in 1982, and I never thought of, I thought, well, that's it, you wouldn't ever want to do it again, it's perfect. So I didn't think of developing it in any way at all. However, 10 years later, in 93, I was asked by Birmingham Repertory Theatre, by the director there, Bill Alexander, great theatre director, and he said, we'd like to put The Snowman on. And have you got any ideas about it? I said, well, actually, I've done a small ballet of it just right now in 93 in Sweden. We've turned it into a 50-minute ballet, and I believe it could be developed further into a full-length show. So he said, would you be interested to do that? And I said, well, I think I could, because what I found is that because I wrote The Snowman in this way, that each character and each little event has its own little theme or a little phrase, you can take those phrases and you can develop them. So when the boy does a big footprints, it only lasts two bars in the film, but I thought, you know, I can make a big footprint dance out of it. I developed The Snowman at that point in 93 into a full-length 90-minute show, and we put it on in Birmingham, and it was a success. Finally, we didn't do much for a while, but then in 97, they wanted to do it again, and this time I brought over Robert North, my choreographer from Sweden, put him together with Bill, brought him together with the great designer, Rory Murchison, and we really... And I rewrote it a bit, and we turned it into really a full-length theatre show. We were then invited to come down to London, and it opened in the Peacock the following year, 98, as The Snowman in the West End. And I went on tinkering with it in the following 2 years, and I added the Jack Frost character and the Ice Princess character, and added various things, but that was eventually, I would say, I got it right by 2000, and I haven't touched a single note or anything in it since 2000, and it has run there at the Peacock for 15 years, making it, I'm told, the longest running Christmas show of all time. It's a very thrilling show to be involved with.
It certainly lives in our heart, I tell you. I mean, I feel extremely lucky to have spoken with such a great composer like yourself, who creates such magic in all you do. And I look forward to seeing both the Sadler's Wells production and Settling Down Christmas Day to be immersed in that magic of The Snowman. So it just remains me to say thank you so much for talking with me today, Howard.
I've much enjoyed it.
Thank you. Me too. And for all the music.
Thank you very much.
And that was Howard Blake, the incredible composer behind so many compositions, including Walking in the Air and The Snowman.